Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. On your dial, always trying to bring you ideas and concepts to help you develop a more positively minded life. Very interesting. We're here in the middle of all of this chaos. You know, it's kind of amazing how we create it when it's not created outside of ourselves. One of my neighbors here said, you know, we were worried about terrorists coming and creating chaos in the city, and we created it ourselves instead. Here we are in the middle of it. But I guess there are means that changes ought to take place. From the Continuum Concept by Jean Liedloff, she said, resistance to change is in no way in conflict with the tendency to evolve. She said, resistance to change is an independent force in keeping any system stable. It's an essential element of growth, resistance to change.
Hmm. Well, it makes sense because the body, as it develops in the child, it has to make an investment of energy into developing in a certain way. And then if you come around and say, well, you have to change now, that means that investment has, you know, been put there for nothing. So it does make sense in the physiological economy of the body that it would resist change.
Liedloff, you know, brought us a lot of different pieces of awareness, brought to our attention by Dr. Christian DeQuincy, who is our guest on the radio with us today, who says we are not who we think we are. Instead, says Dr. DeQuincy, we are what we feel. Giving disciplined attention to feelings reveals the most fundamental fact of life and reality. Now, here it is. Here's the basic fundamental. We are our relationships. Most of us think we're individuals, first and foremost, who then come together to form relationships. But that's not what Dr. DeQuincy believes. So he's the author of a very remarkable, interesting book on quantum physics called Radical Knowing, Understanding Consciousness Through Relationships. Christian, welcome to WBAI.
Hello, welcome. It's good to be here speaking with you.
Yes, that's great. Nice to have you on the air. Tell us a little about this. Tell us about this relationship of relationships and how that defines who we are.
Well, yes, you quoted me saying that we're not who we think we are, and I mean that in two ways. The first, quite literally, that we're not who we think we are, that whatever thoughts we have about who we are or about reality aren't it, because thoughts are abstractions, and they cannot grasp the essence of what is real. I can speak a little bit more about that later on, if you like. But the other point is, we are not who we think we are if we believe that we are individuals first and foremost, which is what our culture, our educational system has conditioned and trained us to believe, is that we are individuals who then grow up and come together and form relationships. What I'm saying is that actually that view has it backwards, that fundamentally relationships come first and individuality is secondary. It grows out of the network of relationships. So who we are at basis is created by these tendrils of relationships that are flowing into us from literally from the entire universe at every moment. And every meeting point in this web or network of relationships, the meeting points are individuals. So you and I are a place where the universe shows up at this point in space and time. And so at this moment, we are mutually creating each other to a great extent. And, of course, that doesn't just mean humans. It also means all other sentient beings.
Our guest is Christian DeQuincy, author of Radical Knowing. Just by chance, Christian, are you on a handheld phone rather than a landline?
I am on a landline.
You're on a landline. It has a wire going into the phone. It's not a remote, because I hear a a hum in the background, I was hoping.
Yeah, I could hear that too. Don't know what that is.
You can't switch phones to another phone, can you?
Not easily.
Okay,
don't. Phone is a wireless.
The one you have is wireless, or the other one is wireless?
The other one is wireless.
And this is as good as we're going, because we must be connected to the universe. And that's the great hum we're hearing.
Right, I was going to say that the universe is humming. Christian, this is Roberta, by the way. Good morning, good afternoon. I don't know what time it is where you are.
Good morning.
Morning, good morning. I wanted to ask you if what you mean by that we are defined by relationships, if you mean to say that in being mirrored and responded to and in interacting with others, we learn from their reaction to us how to define ourselves, is that what you mean?
Well, that's part of what I mean, and so I can mean it in two senses, what I might call the weak sense and the strong sense. The weak sense is that we certainly do influence each other and we inform each other, but I'm saying something stronger than that. I'm saying that not only do we influence and inform each other, that we literally create each other, that who I am is created by the relationships that I am involved with, and who you are is created by the relationships that you are involved with. So it's not just that we are influenced by other people or by other animals or by indeed the world around us. The influence is definitely there, but I'm saying something stronger than that. I'm saying we are actually literally created by that network of relationships.
Yeah. Thank you, Christian. We're going to do a little engineering shift here for a moment. Okay. Roberta?
Yes.
Roberta, tell me from your own perspective.
Sure.
This is very much in agreement with what you believe and what you've been writing about in your new book, is it not?
Yes, my new book, which is called Soul Imprints, is also about the difference that is emerging out of the latest physics, the latest discoveries in physics, the difference in what we used to believe that we are about and what it turns out we are about. That difference is huge, because we really, as Christian is saying, we really kind of call each other into existence by our mutual agreement that we do exist. And it sounds like a crazy thing to say, but it's actually the truth. We all agreed that something exists, and we all agreed that it exists in that form, including ourselves, and so there it is. It manifests. It's like magic.
Well, you know, in order to understand this, I think it might not be a bad idea for us to go back into our evolutionary psychology for a moment.
Sure.
Pulling up the understanding of the continuum concept by Gene Lidloff. And Christian DeQuincy will be back with us in just a quick second. They're rehooking it.
Well, what she's saying is that as babies, humans have been handled in a certain way throughout history, throughout the millions of years of evolution, and therefore the brain and the structure of the nervous system of the human being has developed accordingly. Now, in modern times, that is no longer the case. We handled human babies so differently today from the way we have been doing, that the human nervous system is undergoing quite a challenge of adaptation, because it's no longer what is, you know, the baby, human babies used to being carried around and held all the time, and now we put the emphasis on the opposite. No, get that baby used to being independent.
Well, this thing seemed to have happened, you know. I mean, I like one of the excerpts from the book on the continuum concept, which is, it is no secret that experts have not discovered how to live satisfactorily, but the more they fail, the more they attempt to bring problems under the sole influence of reason and disallow what reason cannot understand or control. Now take this and apply this to mothering. And what happened was, we at some point said the mothering is not working, So we're going to remove the baby, and then we have these Spock children, and we have let the baby cry as long as the baby wants to cry. Christian, are you back with us?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, so take this thought of what happened, according to Liedloff, what happened to the infants and this kind of normal evolution that kind of shifted away to a thoughtful process rather than an intuition process.
Yes, well, I lost you there for a moment, so I don't know if I'm going to repeat some of what you might have been speaking about while I was offline. Well, essentially, Liedloff's thesis is that for hundreds of thousands, in fact, millions of years, our ancestors, when they were born, were held in arms by their primary caregiver. In most cases, that was the mother. And so as evolution proceeded over that great span of time, that became an expectation that when the infant would be born, it would be held in arms, that literally was encoded in the body, in the cells of our ancestors, so that when we are born, every cell in our body has this expectation. It's an unconscious expectation, obviously, but nonetheless it is an expectation that when we are born, we will be held in arms for the first year or two of life, until we decide it's time to make the separation on our own timescale.
Well, that makes sense. What happened?
Well, that has that continuum has been ruptured. That somewhere along the line, as the focus in consciousness shifted from instinct to reason and intellect, people like Dr. Spock came along and started writing books and presenting themselves as experts on mothering and child rearing, and people began to trust the experts and rely on his rational accounts of what he believed would be best for the mother and the infant, and of course to disastrous effects, because one of the things that he advocated was to separate the mother from the infant, that if the baby is put in another room and cries, just let it cry and it will work itself out.
Why do you think that innovation, Roberta, you as well, what do you think brought that idea around? Was it the fact that we may have had so much noise pollution and that there might have been so many things distressing a baby?
No, there is a very simple answer, Armand, and I'm going to go ahead because I've been holding this thought in my mind. No, it's all financial. There's a big financial profit to be made by creating an industry of separation, meaning that when you separate the mother and the child, then you intervene with gadgets and formulas and things to keep the baby occupied and toys and things like that. There's billions of dollars to be made out of that separation.
You
and it's as simple
along,
as that.
Somebody came along and said, hey, let's make a buck. Let's tell everybody that they should let the baby cry.
Let's convince the mothers that they're not good enough. They don't really know how to mother the baby, that we know better. And if we tell them that this formula is better than their milk and this is a toy that's going to help the baby develop more sophisticated nervous system rather than being on the mother's in the mother's arms all day, then if we convince the mothers, then we can sell them a lot of stuff. I mean, in the end, the bottom line, I think, is that.
That's pretty radical. Christian, what do you think?
Well, I think that's definitely part of the equation, but I think it goes much, much deeper than that. I think that's a secondary effect. I would trace it back to something that shifted in the evolution of human consciousness when our reliance on reason, our capacity for reason, developed. And this tied in chronologically with the development of the scientific method and the moment in the history of thought in Europe called the Enlightenment, when the focus was on reason and intellect as the guide to understanding the world and the guide to knowledge and truth. Now, when we shifted to relying on reason as our guide to knowing how the world is put together and knowing how we are related to the world, that's when things began to go off the rails. Now, we can burrow down even a layer deeper than that and recognize that moment in time itself was prompted by the focus on the illusion that we are fundamentally individuals rather than communal beings constituted by relationships. That when we began to believe that we were individuals first and foremost, that supported the sense of being an ego, of being an egoic individual, and the ego will do just about anything it can to preserve that illusion. And one of its great servants in that is turning to the intellect and reasoning, to the mental intellectual mind, as a way of keeping the ego in place. So the ego operates through abstractions and reasoning and intellect, whereas relationships are based on feeling. So when we shifted from knowing who we are and knowing the world through feeling primarily to knowing the world through reason, we were focusing on the illusion of being an egoic individual and losing sight of our deep embedded connectedness with the rest of nature, including other human beings and other animals. And then, following on from that, the ego obviously then began to develop the technologies and consumerist products that Roberta was just speaking about.
Well,
that was secondary.
When you talk about feelings, Christian, are you talking about intuition and senses? You're not talking about guilt and anger and things like that. You're talking about a different sense, aren't you? What is feelings?
Guilt and anger are they're emotions. See, by feeling, I mean literally what we feel in our body. Right now, as I'm sitting here, I can feel the chair beneath me. I can feel a constriction in my chest because I have a cold today. So I mean literally the feelings in the body, the feelings that course through the body.
Now, when you have two people connected to each other, a mother and a child, there is a lot of feeling that courses through the body between the two of them.
Yes.
And the child has little differentiation between it and its parents and it and its cribs. And we consider one of the signs of maturation that the child learns that it's separate. We consider that to be psychological, on the way to psychological adultness. You know,
yes,
that the child must learn that it is separate. And you're saying, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is part of the mistake. The mistake is the child doesn't know it's separate. It doesn't have to know it's separate. It isn't.
Well, we are both individual and in relationship. Both are true. And unfortunately, in our civilization, we focus our attention on the individuality as though that were primary. What I'm saying is that, yes, we are individuals. I mentioned earlier about the fact that if we picture the world, the universe, as this network of relationships, of tendrils of fibers of relationships flowing together at different meeting points, at different nodes. Each node in that web is an individual. And those individuals are real. You are real and I am real as individuals. But that is not our deepest, most fundamental nature. The most fundamental nature of who we are these relationships that come together to form us. So individuation as a psychological process of development is important. We need to recognize that we do have this center of creativity, of sense of being an individual, but that is not the ultimate nature of who we are. If we focus exclusively on that, then we lose our connection, our felt connection with the rest of the world around us, and that's the problem. It's not that we shouldn't develop the sense of being individual, but not to believe that that's who we are fundamentally.
So you believe back to the old, the constant physical contact with the mother or another familiar caregiver from birth, which is the old style that we did before we became so smart, and then sleeping on the parent's bed in constant physical contact until he leaves of his own volition, which usually is about 2 years, as opposed to, you know, the person who wants to leave his mother's bed when he's 22, right? Breastfeeding on cue means that that the child just says it's time to breastfeed and goes for it, and the mother doesn't limit and try to train when the child breastfeeds.
So
things
yes,
like that.
Yeah. If you're asking me, do I support that as a way of relating to our infants? Absolutely. It's what our evolutionary history has conditioned us to expect, and if we don't honor that, then what we end up doing is rupturing that evolutionary continuum. And what happens is if every cell in our body is crying out for that physical flesh-to-flesh contact and it isn't provided, the infant, which doesn't yet have the capacity to figure things out, just feels there is something profoundly wrong here. And it then assumes in its preverbal state, there is something wrong with me. And so when that rupture is made, that child will grow up with the sense of something deeply missing, something deeply wrong. There's a void in its experience that it will do anything to fill that void, and that then becomes the source of addictions, whether it's alcohol or sex and so on.
But changes in evolution, and changes in the different conditions. I mean, a man marries a woman, he wants to lay in bed with her, and he wants to be in bed with her, and he doesn't necessarily want to have an infant suckling on his wife's breast for 2 years while he's trying to lay in bed with it, but the child is not being separated, so the child stays in bed while they have sex. Is this kind of, you know, it just sounds like society has kind of pulled this and said it necessitates this not being as natural as you're saying, that we've got to kind of separate because otherwise the couple is not connected. Now it's parent-child, there's a whole connection, and couple-couple is not connected.
Okay, I'm not clear why the fact that by keeping the infant with the parents, that would lead to the sense that the parents are no longer connected. In fact, I would think that it would enhance the sense of connectivity and relationship between the parents.
You think a couple who is in bed romantically having their child in bed at that same time would enhance their relationship?
I don't see why it wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's continue. It's interesting stuff. Because you say that the feelings would be shared there between the three of them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Have you seen this done anywhere?
No, I haven't witnessed it. I've grown up, like most of us in this society, in a culture that doesn't honor the continuum that actually separated infant and mother or infant and parents. So we don't actually have that in our culture as an experience. But you opened this part of the conversation by saying that the husband might prefer not to have the infant around. Well, no doubt that may be the case in our culture, but that's just that one person's egoic preference matched against the millions of years of the evolutionary expectation that the infant carries within it. And so if we go with to try and satisfy the longings of the selfish longings of the father, then that's going to have a negative effect on both the infant and ultimately on the parents as well.
Well, let me just see now, Roberta. Don't you think that way back when, if there was an alpha male and there was a secondary female, and the male gave a female a baby, and she has the baby, or they have a baby, I guess he's not sleeping with her. He's not coming by at night saying, "I have needs."
No, because there wasn't a nuclear family system, 500,000 years ago. It was more of a group living, tribal, I don't know what to call it.
Uh-huh.
So that, and I don't believe that people knew that babies would come from sex. So that it wasn't so much that the baby was the product of this behavior that people engaged in. So I don't think that there was much of an issue with babies being asleep wherever they were asleep, because they didn't have all the mental stuff that we have, like Dr. Quincy is saying. They didn't think the way we do. We think in terms of how relationships should be structured according to the current morality, the current legality, the current philosophy, the current belief system, and that was not an issue back then, Armand.
Well, we're gonna get to radical knowing. You know, Christian De Quincey, by chance, Christian, I know we have a couple of friends in common. Do you know Cherry Quincey?
Actually, I do. Yes.
Isn't that remarkable? Right up there on the mountain with her husband Joel. You know the two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. What, Cherry Quincey and Christian De Quincey. Very close. She's an interesting thinker, Cherry is.
Yeah.
She's been on our show many times. One of those unusual thinkers.
See, Christian, I didn't mean to say a while ago that the modern technology that profits from the separation is the cause of the separation. Because in fact, I don't know when the separation occurred. You seem to think that it occurred much longer ago than I do. See, I seem to think that you're speaking of the Enlightenment period, and you're speaking of the, I'm assuming, the Cartesian style of cosmology, etc. I think that the separation, the way we see it today, the Dr. Spock style separation, is only a very recent event, and it has only come about because of the needs of an industry that was being set up and created precisely to supply this kind of product. So, you know, like if you go 200 years ago, 300 years ago, I don't think mothers had formula. I don't think mothers would even think of not breastfeeding a baby and not sleeping with the baby for, you know, the first couple of years. So you seem to think that it goes on, that it started much longer ago than I do.
No, I'm not saying that the separation of mother and infant started way back then. I'm saying that the tendency to rely on reason as the predominant way of knowing, which is what gave rise to folks like so-called experts like Dr. Spock coming on the scene.
Uh-huh.
And the Industrial Revolution itself was a product of the reliance on reason and the Scientific Revolution. So what I'm doing is I'm tracing it further back to the mode of consciousness that trusted far more in the intellect and reason, which is a much more recent arrival on the scene than instinct and intuition, which go back, in fact, to the beginnings of time, as I understand the way the world is put together.
And the loss of instinct and intuition is one of the great separators, which we're going to talk about at some length when we get back from our break, because it is trying to get back that instinct and intuition that we had, and trying to include that in our relationships with people in our lives now, as well as our relationship to everything around us, that I think Dr. DeQuincy is talking about. I mean, it's, we've kind of even got 7 steps for how to do it, right? This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti and the wise author, Radical of Radical Knowing, Understanding Consciousness Through Relationship, Dr. Christian DeQuincy. Will be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends, but some special music for you today, too. Unusual turn of music.
This is WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas, heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Percussion, my friends. Classical music set to percussion makes sense. When I was a kid, I was a drummer, and as a drummer, I used to always put on things. I liked, you know, I liked the early Bach would be great to drums. It was terrific. It was terrific. Armand DeMille here, the Brandenburg Concerto needed bongos. Armand DeMille here. Well, while we're at it, you know, we're talking about radical knowing. This is kind of the thing, you know. The intellect removed us from our instincts. And what we're talking with Dr. Christian DeQuincy and Roberta Atti about the consequences of our over-intellectualizing. But as we're talking about it, we are over-intellectualizing.
Of course.
About the over-intellectualizing. How do we get away from it?
Well, the intellect likes to intellectualize, doesn't it? That's its main function.
Well, let's get back to Christian DeQuincy for a minute. Christian, what turned you in this direction? I mean, were you a guy who thought differently at one point, or were you always thinking that there's going to be some Buddhist kind of connection to everything that you'd like to be able to bring to the public? And, you know, what turned you in this direction about the relationships?
I'll come to that in a second. I also want to just comment on the point you raised just a second ago about intellectualizing the idea that we over-intellectualize and that there's no way around that. Actually, there is. That what has tended to happen is we use reason by hooking abstract thoughts together and then assuming that that's going to lead us to reality. If we pay attention, we will recognize that every thought that we've ever had began as an experience, began as a feeling in our bodies. Every thought began as a feeling. And what has happened is we have disconnected the thoughts, we have abstracted the thoughts from those feelings. And so we now deal with these abstractions, and that's why people say you are in your head. But if we reconnect that process of thinking with the feelings in the body, then thought and thinking and intellectualization and reason has a very different quality to it.
Are you doing that right this minute?
I'm attempting to.
Yeah, are you attempting to make the connection between you and me and Roberta, as well as your connection to the universe through the senses in your body?
Yes, and if I do that successfully, then the quality of my communication is going to be richer, that you will sense that shift, you will sense that difference. when I'm speaking from my body, an embodied way of reasoning rather than abstract reasoning.
Well, one, it's a funny thing, because one of my ways of making that connection with you was to mention to you that we had a lot of friends in common.
Yes.
And what I was doing when I went out there, and I know we have five or six people that we've actually shared contact with,
yeah,
then I was saying to you, okay, here, this distance between where you are and where we are is not so far, and there is some kind of a connection, and here we are on the airwaves, and you are also somebody who's done your own radio program, haven't you?
No, I haven't had my own radio program. I've been on many radio programs, but I haven't actually had my own.
Oh, I saw a photograph of you with a headset on.
Oh, that was an interview with somebody we probably also know in common, Jeffrey Mishlove.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
So there you are. I mean, here we are. Now, I imagine as well, Christian, that at some point you were somebody who was studying the nature of beings and the nature of the universe, and you fell in love. It sounds real clear that this is a man who found a connection to somebody.
Yeah, it's definitely a passion of mine. And your question earlier was, you know, how did this happen for me? Well, actually, in my case, it began a long time ago. The earliest I can remember being interested in this issue was when I was a kid in Ireland, 7 or 8 years old. It was a rainy afternoon, and I had nothing to do, so I pulled down my father's encyclopedia from the bookshelf and started flipping through it and came across an entry in evolution and started reading. Now, I didn't understand a lot of what was going on, but I recognized that it was telling me not only did I come from my parents and that they came from their parents and grandparents and all the way back to the beginning of humanity, but that humans themselves came from some prior ape-like ancestor that came from a prior mammal, that came from a reptile, that came from amphibians, that came from fish, that came from jellyfish, all the way back in that old encyclopedia to what it called infusoria, single-celled creatures that today we would call bacteria. And so I was amazed to realize that my earliest relatives were bacteria. But even more than that, what struck me was, here I am sitting, wondering and pondering about the evolution of life. Where did that capacity for wonderment first arise in the great unfolding of evolution? That was the question that really set me on my track to becoming a philosopher. Where in the great unfolding of evolution did consciousness first arise? And so that became my life's work.
And then at some point you found a mate.
Yes.
Because that's where it begins to change, when you get hands-on. Do you know what I mean? When you go from your thinking to your feeling process, then something happened to you in relationship. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yes. I'm trained in philosophy, and I've always been fascinated by the power of the mind and the intellect, and I've read a lot of books and have a very deep understanding, I think, of philosophy. So my natural inclination is to honor the gift of reason. And then some years ago, 10 years or so ago, I met my current partner, who relates to the world very, very differently. She's predominantly a feeling person who relies to a great extent on intuition and has mystical and spiritual experiences that I've only read about. And so in the early days of our relationship, we would talk about that, and I would ask her to explain and describe what was going on in these spiritual journeys that she would take. What surprised me is that in those early days, almost invariably, those conversations would end in tears, that she would feel that as I would probe and ask questions with my philosopher's mind, looking for logical, rational precision, she would feel that she was being violated, that her experiences were being invalidated, even though that's not what I intended to do. From my perspective, I was just trying to understand what was going on in her experience. But my way of understanding was using the tool of reason and probing with, as I said, with the fine precision of logic. In her experience, that was suppressing her. It was a violation of her experience. And so that was a real puzzle to me, what was going on here. And then,
and you're in the middle of describing the dilemma of many mates.
Yes.
Many people have with their mates, you know, here's reason and there's feelings, and how could we be so separate? So what happened next?
So what happened is that a couple of years into our relationship, I was giving a talk, ironically enough, on intersubjectivity, which is the technical term in philosophy for consciousness based in relationship. So I was giving a talk at a conference in Arizona on intersubjectivity, and during one of the breaks, I wandered around and I found at one of the poster sessions a paper by an anthropologist from Stanford University called Pre-Conquest Consciousness. And I started reading, and it really stopped me in my tracks, because he was describing two fundamental modes of consciousness that he called pre-conquest and post-conquest. And the conquest referred to the time when the conquistadors came over from Europe to the New World and invaded the way of life of the indigenous peoples, bringing a reason-based consciousness to a feeling-based consciousness that was indigenous to the first world. Now, what happens, as he described it, is that when these two modes of consciousness encounter each other, when reason-based consciousness encounters a feeling-based mode of consciousness, the inevitable result is that the feeling-based consciousness feels dominated and suppressed and eventually even obliterated by the reason-based consciousness. And that really caught my attention, because I was experiencing that in my own personal relationship. And now I was recognizing it as a generality that could explain what goes on in the relationship between one culture and another culture, between science and shamanism, between science and spirituality, that when you have a reason-based mode of consciousness encountering a feeling-based mode of consciousness, one will apparently inevitably squash the other. And the reason for that is that reason is essentially dialectical. It will pose one idea and then confront it with an opposite or a different idea in the hope that out of that there will be a synthesis that will produce new knowledge. So there is this dialectical dynamic in reason that is essentially confrontational.
And of course, it is always going to win over the emotional, non-dialectical process of an emotion-based or a feeling-based.
Well, a feeling-based, even rather than emotion-based, a feeling-based mode of consciousness, which not being dialectical, it's actually dialogical. It's based on feeling the well-being of the relationship. So this pre-conquest feeling-based mode of consciousness, its search for truth is what feels best for the collective, whereas the search for truth with the reason-based dialectical consciousness is looking for truth through the precision of language and concepts, and this dialectic of presenting a thesis and then counteracting it with an antithesis.
So then when you looked at this and you looked and you said, well, there she is. Yeah. She's a pre-conquest conscious and I'm a post-conquest conscious, and what's the matter with me? Why don't I understand her way? Did a tear come to your eye?
So what happened to me was to recognize that there are different ways of knowing, and that we need to be aware of these different ways of knowing in relationship and to honor them. And so what I write about in Radical Knowing are what I call the four gifts of knowing. I recognize that actually we all have these four gifts, and we need to cultivate and integrate them. And the four gifts are the scientist's gift of the senses. We all have the senses, our senses that we use to see and hear and touch and taste the world around us. We all have those senses. Then we also have the philosopher's gift of reason. We also then have the ability to analyze the data that we gain through the senses. And those are the two modes that are predominant in our culture and in our educational system. But besides the senses and reason, we have two other dominant ways of knowing, two other crucial ways of knowing. The shaman's gift of feeling and altered states of consciousness, knowing the world through feeling and through altered states of consciousness, not just through the rational, intellectual, egoic state of consciousness. And then the fourth mode is the mystic's gift of sacred silence, of transcendental intuition. So what we need to do to have a rounded sense of who we are and wisdom is we need to cultivate and develop and integrate all of these four gifts of knowing: the scientist's gift of the senses, the philosopher's gift of reason, the shaman's gift of feeling and altered states of consciousness, and the mystic's gift of sacred silence and transcendental intuition.
So it would seem to me that at some point you looked at your newfound mate from 10 years ago, And you said, you know, all of my words don't have any meaning. What I need to do is be quiet to embrace her, because then my feelings will emerge and then I will be able to connect with her. And through that connection, this magical connection you had with this person, it kind of opened that world to you, a world that you've been searching for.
Yes, to recognize the power of silence. And over the years, I've become involved with a mode of exploring consciousness called Bohmian dialogue, based on the work of David Bohm, the quantum physicist, where a group of people will sit in silence for many hours, just feeling and being together, and letting whatever might be spoken to arise out of that silence, to speak from the silence rather than speaking to fill the silence, which is what tends to happen in our society. So I have been developing the practice of speaking from silence rather than speaking to fill the silence.
How do you speak from silence?
By feeling, by paying attention to our feelings. First of all, by shutting up and stop speaking. To demonstrate that over the radio probably wouldn't be very good radio. But to just fall into silence, to fall into feeling, and to pay attention to those feelings in our bodies, and to begin to do what I call feel our thinking, to recognize that our thinking begins as feelings in our bodies, and then let those feelings be the guide to what we think and what we speak, rather than the abstractions that we play around with in our heads.
You know, a friend of mine, do you know Dieter Scheid in Italy by chance?
No, I don't.
He does work with Bohmian groups.
Uh-huh.
And he has this big place in Chianti where he invites large groups of people to do just this. And they have a little sign on the wall that says, "Never miss an opportunity to keep your mouth shut."
Oh, wonderful.
Roberta, yeah. You wanted to ask a question.
Yes, I did. Well, what I'm hearing is that Christian is describing the dysfunctional side of intellect, which is the side that tends to leave the present and take flight into time, into the future, into the past. And that started with language, of course. You know, when we started to speak is when we started to figure out that there was a future and a past. And the question I have for Christian is, A, do you agree that the feeling experience that you are describing is an experience that is is able to remain in the present, that is able not to leave and to go into the future, into the past? And B, how do you do that for a person who is, like yourself, very intellectually sophisticated and who is using his mind constantly to explore reality? How do you sort of rein it back in and bring it all into the present where the rest of you is?
Wonderful question, two-part question. So the first part is, how do we keep the feeling and the experience in the present? Well, actually, we don't need to do that, because that's always where it is. Feelings and experience always happen in the present. And then what happens is we have an experience, and the moment we have the experience, we then interpret the experience. Now, already we're beginning to go off track with the interpretation. Then the next step in the process, the next phase, is we then turn the interpretation into a belief. And then the next step in the process is we then begin to believe our beliefs, and that's the foundation of dogmatism. And then if we act out of that, that's when our actions become dysfunctional. What I'm recommending we do is to connect action with the beginning of that process, which is the experience itself, which is right now in the moment. Experiences are always occurring right now, right now, right now. So by focusing our attention, beginning to focus our attention on the feelings in our bodies, those are the experiences that are embodied with us, that brings us right back into the present moment. Which kind of comes back to the second part of your question. What do I do to attempt to get there? Well, I spend as much time as I can sitting in silence, either in meditation privately or in dialogue groups with other people, to let my mind settle down and then just recognize that who I am fundamentally are these feelings that connect me with the world around me, that the feelings that come through our bodies are literally messages from the world around us. And that's how that's the source of wisdom, is by paying attention to the feelings in our bodies and then recognizing that those feelings are literally messages from the world around us, from the rest of nature.
Thank you very much, Dr. Christian De Quincey, author of Radical Knowing, who has been with us today. I want to thank you so much for that. You know, it becomes a particularly interesting time now, Roberta, because I think now, since there are so many people out there in the world, as you walk around the streets and people are not in the subways.
I liked it so much, Armand. It was so wonderful.
Yeah, you get a chance to feel the connection.
See the faces. Yes, I loved it.
And it's, again, you know, you feel that if you take a moment outside of your thinking and you get a sense of what that connection is to all the people out there, you could feel this sea of humanity that we are connected to no matter what. And to get angry at anybody who's in the middle of this strike, one way or another, is to kind of not feel the picture of it. We are connected. We're in the middle of this. This is something that connects all of us, and it brought us out of the dungeons. It brought us out of the underground.
I know.
Above ground.
Look at us. We're all outside today. No one is underground. Isn't that wonderful? It was fantastic to walk around and look at the faces of people and look at other people's eyes. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
How many chances do you get to do that with so many people out there, you know?
Right. It was great.
So you took a long trip here today. You came in from New Jersey, and you got here, and you came up from Penn Station.
Right.
Dedicated to being with us.
Christian.
He's gone.
Oh, he's gone. Okay. I just had one last question. But anyway, yes, that was very enjoyable. It was a treat, Armand, to be outside with all these people. And I'm on my way off to Italy. As I leave here, I jump on a plane, and there I go. So I want to wish the listeners happy holidays and safe holidays and wonderful holidays. And let's enjoy the strike, because as you said, Armand, when do we get a chance to look at one another the way we did today?
Let's enjoy the strike, and you're on your way to Italy?
Let's not think about that part.
You're full of bologna.
Absolutely.
All right, Roberta, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank Dr. Christian De Quincey. I hope this is really fascinating. It is interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm,
we will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. My friends, if you want a copy of today's program, you could listen to it on the Internet. And, you could go to thepositivemind.com.
My website is creativehealthsolutions.org.
And if you want a hard copy of the program, you could call 212-757-4488. My special thanks to all of you, and to you, Michael G., for engineering today. Back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. I'm